Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Wednesday in time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Greg Audell. And alongside a team saturated in talent, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, media maven and engineer Nicole Rocherlin, and gifted intern Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of storytelling by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls and transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely to the here and now. You know, I'm the only one that's not a doctor. I don't know how I got into this very smart crowd. For nearly 10 years, we've hosted outstanding storytellers, inspired by memorable episodes that trigger stories worth telling, the kind frozen in time and thawed when told. And you've told us to keep doing it. From the 2008 monthly gig to our current primetime weekly program, it's you, each of you, who tell us that storytelling, with its riveting allure, is worth your time by pledging during our fund drives, just like the one we are starting tonight. A time when you remind KPFT that So What's Your Story belongs in their eclectic program inventory. The station, Pacifica Radio, was inspired by the peace movement following World War II when we knew that corporations shouldn't filter the programming we enjoy. That's what you're paying for. But more specifically, when you call 713-526-5738, to speak to one of our steadfast volunteers or go online to kpft.org, then to donations, specify a form of payment, and this is very important, scroll to So What's Your Story as your favorite program and make a pledge to one of our volunteers and let them know that it's So What's Your Story you are designating as your favorite. You are telling us that human connections matter. Don't take my word for it, because tonight you'll hear what we're all about. Because my guest will prove that stories stretch the boundaries of the human heart. My guests tonight are both gifted storytellers, each able to harness their skills to reach any audience and oftentimes render them in awe. Baton Rouge native and history teacher Joseph Crump moved around a little bit before settling in Houston, but he got back here as fast as he could. After dropping out of Baylor, he became a rock star. A sense of reality ignited him to enroll in U of H to pursue a degree in history. Good thing, because Joe has been a remarkable middle school history teacher, combined with the commitment expected from the consummate educator. He is also a proud dad to a curious 15-year-old son, who is an excellent stair climber, I can attest, and the father-son bonding defines who Joe is today. For Chris Gorman, being a daydreamer was essential to helping her survive 27 years in customer service. 27 years worth of stories, I would think. Dreams, however, was the ignition to getting Chris to the Moth so that she could engage unsuspecting listeners in some of the wildest and best-told stories this side of the Milky Way. She also loves nurturing her blind dog, Big Boy, through his personal renaissance. Now, Chris, this is hardly your first time here. Our audience is familiar with your work, and we're glad to have you back in the studio.
Thanks. It's always fun to come here. I have a good time each time.
Well, you make it fun. And Joe, we are proud that this is your first time on air with us. Welcome to So What's Your Story?
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And thank you both for joining us for our special pledge drive edition of So What's Your Story? We always look forward to having you in the house, Chris, and congratulations on your, your fifth Moth Story Slam win last night?
That could be true.
Wow! That is amazing. I think you probably now hold the Houston record, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm warning you, I'm coming after you.
I know
it. I am coming after you.
I know it. I just had a head start on you because I went to the first one.
Oh, well.
That was what it was.
I'm motivated.
I lapped you.
Well, I feel like you're always going to be one or two ahead of me, but, you know, I'm going to work on it.
Oh, I doubt it.
You're obviously doing a lot of things right in the world of storytelling. What is that piece of magic that comes from storytelling? It's very hard to describe to people, but you know when you're up there telling the story.
I think that you have to really care about whatever it is that you're telling a story about. If it's something that doesn't interest you, there's no way you're going to make anyone else care what you're saying.
That is so true, because I have found when I have done best at the Moth, they're stories that don't require memorization because I know them so well and they mean so much to me. And when I stretch it, when there's a theme that doesn't really speak to me and I try and create a story, it just doesn't sit well with me, and I don't think it sits that well with the audience.
I think I agree on that one.
Yeah, there's something about authenticity. And I think it's maybe why I was a lousy actor. It was very hard for me to memorize and read other people's words and infuse it with emotion. But when they're my stories and that emotion is real, it's very easy for me to share that with the audience. And I've certainly seen you do that time and time and time and time and time again.
Well, when you're emotional, it's easy sometimes to share it with people. Some people are just not as emotional as others.
What inspired you to step out on that stage the first time?
I don't know. It was something new to try, to be honest with you. It was the very first one, and no one knew what we were supposed to do, I don't think. And it was funny because Warren was there, and Warren won.
Oh, and I know the story he won with.
Me too. It is fantabulous.
And Warren always manages to give me goosebumps. And you know, the first time I told a story at the Moth, I had never been, and I got called first, and I won that night too. There was an advantage in not knowing
what
other people were doing. I just did what I did.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Joe, everyone starts with a first appearance, and this is yours. But you've been telling stories more than most of us because of your job. Tell us how storytelling helps shape you teaching history and helps make you more effective teacher.
Well, I think you have to add relevance to it, and the kids appreciate it a lot more if they find relevance to their lives, but also if you're very passionate about what you're saying. And so I have an unbridled passion for history, and I think my kids pick up on that.
It's funny, you're really saying the same thing we just said, you know, that, I mean,
absolutely.
You feel it, and it's easy to convey, and they can pick up on it.
Yeah.
Though I would imagine there are maybe one day every now and then where they're not quite in awe of you.
No.
Well played. Well played. What's the single ingredient in stories that helps your kids learn history?
Like I said, probably the relevance, but you kind of figure out the certain things that appeal to different types of kids, like the boys like the war type stuff, and the girls like to hear about, you know, women's suffrage movement and that kind of thing. So you learn that different subjects of the day will appeal to different students. But, you know, you just have to find something every day that'll kind of ignite that interest in them.
And people think teaching is an easy job?
Well, it gets easier.
I'm sure, but you got to be on your toes.
You do, but you learn how to manage the kids, and you learn how to tell the stories. And it's very hard at first, which is why so many quit in the first couple of years. But you just got to stick with it.
The two stories you have for us tonight represent the range of human emotions, the kind that only stories can produce. Your first is a perfect story for this time of year. It's a powerful one that reminds us that our actions send currents to others in ways we can never anticipate. Tell us your story.
Well, I'd like to take you all back to North Carolina in 1996 in a sleepy town just outside of Asheville, North Carolina. Where there was an all-boys summer camp that I used to attend from age 13 to 16. And this place was really just paradise for teenagers, I'd have to say. Really, and all-boys, but it was an overnight camp. It was a a Christian camp, not the scary kind you see in documentaries where they tell you that Harry Potter's the devil and they train kids to, you know, attack abortion clinics and that kind of thing. So it was pretty cool and laid back, and, you know, they were big on character building. And integral to the system was a kind of a Native American ranking system. And I didn't feel like it was cheesy or anything. I felt like it was dignified. And once a week, if you were good, your counselor would promote you from Pathfinder to Flying Eagle or something like that. But to get the highest rank, you had to undergo a rigorous selection process and then a test. The highest rank was called Little Chief, and these were elite campers with special privileges. And if you weren't a Little Chief, then you wanted to be one. And basically, if you had the highest rank, then you were eligible, the second highest rank, then you were eligible to become a Little Chief. And your counselor would nominate you, and then your name would go before the other Little Chiefs, and they would vote on you. And if you made it to the third stage, the director would either cut your name or maybe add you. And if you were on that final list, then you were awoken from your bunk at midnight on a secret night and taken up the mountain to undergo a series of tests. And throughout the entire night and the whole next day, you couldn't utter a word or you'd fail and have to wait the entire year to try again. They'd give you a match and half sheet of newspaper, and you had to start a fire and keep it going all night. Again, if you talked at all, you were out. And say, "I'm sorry," and walk you back down the hill, and you signed a book, and, you know, you join the Hall of Shame. The next day, they take you to a secret location, and you run up a hill. If you stopped running, you failed. Again, if you talked, you failed. And then you had to go the whole next day without talking, and you had to go to canoeing and riflery, arts and crafts. And you couldn't say anything, or you'd fail. I had one kid that I pulled at dinner, asked someone to pass the bread, and he was 30 minutes away from getting it. And they said, "I'm sorry, you fail." And so it was a big deal, and people would cry over it, and everybody really wanted it. And so one year when I was 16, there was a boy named Sean who was part of our group, part of our cabin. And he was the kind of kid who walked right in and just had emotional battle scars on his face. You could just see that he had endured years of merciless bullying. And we were really nice to him, but he was always very defensive and didn't have any of the characteristics that we would expect in a candidate for this esteemed position. And one day the director of the camp, named John, pulled us all aside and said, "I would like you all to consider pulling Sean for Little Chief." And we were aghast. We thought this was a terrible idea. You know, he wasn't respected, he wasn't nice to people, he wasn't any of these things. But John was very smooth and charismatic, and he could, truth be told, he could probably sell a ketchup popsicle to a woman in white gloves. He was that good, and we knew he was that good, so we had our guard up. But in the end, he said, "You can use your position of power for good, or you can use it to feel like you have an elite status and you have power over people." And so he kind of guilt-tripped us in that way, and I suppose it worked, because in a few minutes we were all persuaded that we really had to do this. And so in a separate night, not the night when everyone else was getting pulled, but the entire cabin pulled Sean for Little Chief. And I'll never forget the look on his face. It was like, you know, a million Christmases times a thousand. He was just, it was like nothing he had ever experienced in his life. And we took him up the hill, and he passed the fire section, and when we got to the run, he didn't make it on the run. And so we got to the top of the run, and we broke the news to him, and he started to cry. And we all kind of gathered around him, and we put our hands on him and said a prayer, and everybody contributed something meaningful and tried to make him feel good about the situation. And as we walked down the hill, everyone was in really good spirits. He seemed pleased with himself. We felt like we had done a good thing. And I never fully grasped the impact of what we did until the final council ring, when all the parents came and they gave out all these awards. And the director said, "Anyone who has been pulled for Little Chief, step forward." And the Sean that I saw step out of the crowd into the middle of the arena was an entirely new Sean. And I haven't kept up with him. I don't know if it made a significant impact in his life, but I think looking back, John was right. And I think sometimes you have to break convention in order to do something good for somebody. And I hope he took that with him and went on to do great things and realized that he has self-worth and can make meaningful contributions.
Wow.
What a powerful story. My first question that comes to mind when you talk about not knowing if it still impacted his life, I'm curious, how has it impacted yours?
I guess sometimes as a teacher, you know, you might break protocol or do things differently for different students. Because not
every
all
kid needs something different.
Right. Not all students have, you know, a good upbringing. You know, some students, you know, in many schools in HIC, you have students with single parents or abusive parents, or they've endured unimaginable hardship. And, you know, a lot of times you have to realize that these aren't problem kids. These are kids with problems.
Amen. Amen. And it also comes to mind, one of my favorite sayings is that people will generally live up or down to your expectations.
I think that's true. And if you hold those kids accountable to those expectations, they appreciate it. It means, you know, you think highly of them.
Well, and you know, this is one of my favorite stories because I know I'm going to be thinking about it on the drive home tonight, and I'll probably be thinking about it tomorrow. Chris, what have you gained from your relationship with storytelling?
Well, just in specific, you know, the moth stories. In order to find a moth story, you have to re-examine your life in a way.
You sure do.
That is not something I don't think everyone does. And you have to do it in a very curated way because they're looking for something very specific depending on what the topic is. So you have to think, did anything like that ever happen to me? And then you have to, if you're going to be effective at it, you really have to feel back through that time in your life to find out what was important about it that makes you feel like you want to tell it to somebody else. Who would care?
No, that's so true. And particularly, there is a difference between telling one or two good stories and being successful, and that's a good thing, and being a storyteller. Whereas you say, you're really examining so many different portions of your life because, you know, I know most of us involved in this at least every month are trying to come up with a brand new story that relates to your life. And you're absolutely right. You do examine it in ways you never have before. And you kind of have to scratch your head and think, okay, what am I really willing to stand up in front of 1,000 people and share?
That, and you want to hopefully share something that means something to someone else rather than just to you. You know, otherwise you're just telling something that happened to you. You want someone to come up afterwards and say, yeah, I felt that
yeah.
way too.
And at the risk of being sounding like an egomaniac, I mean, it is a special thing when someone you've never seen before comes up to you with tears in their eyes and says, oh my God, you know, this story spoke to me because, like, wow, I didn't know
I had anything in common with anyone on the earth. I think that's really what I felt the first time someone said that to me. And then I found out
right. There
was maybe one person.
I think you've proven there are a few more. And Chris, this is, I believe, your third guest spot on the program, at least?
I think so.
At least.
I've had fun coming here to tell different things. So
and certainly not your last. And you are one of the reasons that we are Houston's premier storytelling program. And my friends, we are reminding you that it is Pledge Drive tonight, and I would love for you to tell our listeners what this show has meant to you. You can call right now at 713-526-5738. Talk to one of our trusty volunteers and tell them what the show means to you. We would love to be able to thank you on air, just like I want to thank my fellow co-host, Mary Edgerton, who has offered a $100 matching contribution for everyone that calls in with a $100 contribution during this show. And I'll double check, but I believe I have that correct. And you can also donate by going to kpft.org, listing your select how you want to pay, and then picking So What's Your Story as your favorite program. It's certainly my favorite program. Now, Chris, we want to hear one of your signature stories. Would you tell us your first story?
Well, I'm going to tell you a story.
All right.
Well, I was spending a lot of time on Facebook and not on my friend's feed. That takes like 30 seconds. I was in this dusty little corner of Facebook called Facebook Events. It turns out that if one person wants to do something with one other person, There's probably a Facebook event for that, and in a city this size, that means there's hundreds of them every single day. So I spent a lot of time scrolling through these events, and it was weird. Most of them said zero people interested, zero people going. And I just started feeling so sorry for these events. Sometimes I would hit interested, or even going, thinking that maybe if I did that, there'd be some sort of a viral wave, and then there'd be big crowds of happy people doing, like, Czechoslovakian watercolor or comparing facial hair or whatever the event was. But I was spending too much time doing that, and I realized I wasn't feeling sorry for the events. I was just feeling sorry for myself. So I watched a Goalcast video, and then I watched an inspirational Will Smith video. And I made a promise right there to Will Smith. The next time I saw a Facebook event that looked even halfway promising, I was going to hit going. And then I was going to go to that event. And then I saw it. Gay kickball. And I just wanted to go Nicholson on that and say, is there any other kind? But actually, gay kickball is a real thing. There's a league here in Houston, and it's supposed to be a way for gay people to get together and socialize without alcohol being involved. Actually, the happy hour is directly afterwards. So I was reading the description, and there was one word in there that just made a pain start in my chest, and it was the word inclusive. When I was in high school, it was the late 80s. There was AIDS on every doorknob. We did not have a gay straight alliance club at my high school, unless you counted our Duran Duran fan club. Being gay was always a solo sport for me, whether I was dodging beer cans thrown from the back of a truck or just learning to run really fast when somebody screamed, "Faggot!" This all happened to me, and I'm a girl. So I knew this was going to be super challenging for me. So the day came, and I'm walking my third time around the outside of this park, and I'm peering at the people gathering at the picnic tables like some sort of a myopic cheetah, and I was going to leave. But then they started playing I Will Survive. And I thought, well, maybe I could survive. So I went over and I signed my name on the paper. And all of a sudden, I just felt this odd sense of ease. All I had to do was be here and be queer. I got used to it. So my team captain had seen me walk up in my library attire. And he said, hey, our team has a mathematician on it, and he has determined statistically that there is one place in the outfield where no kickball has ever been kicked, and no kickball will ever be kicked. And I'm like, dude, sign me up. So I learned how to outfield, which basically just meant looking really expectant when the other team kicked the ball, and then clapping really loud when someone on my team got that ball. And I did have my turn at bat. I got up there and I kicked a super stylish foul ball, like straight through the cheerleading section, and I knocked over all their rosé. And my team captain just came out and said, hey, that was a good kick. Next time, that way. Okay, so we're crushing them. We're crushing them. And then it happened. The other team kicked a really super high fly ball, and I saw it in the stratosphere. It looked like a bubblegum pink asteroid. And it was coming down straight at me. And I was going to run. But then I said, wait a minute. This is my team. These are my people. I need to stand up for my team. So I just kind of made my body into a human catcher's mitt. And I closed my eyes. And a couple seconds later, I heard that ball hit the ground a statistically impossible 2 feet to my left. And I was like, oh no. But then I channeled my inner Will Smith. I opened my eyes, and I got jiggy with it. I went over there, and I got that ball, and I threw it to my nearest teammate who knew how to throw more than shade. And we made a play out of it, and we won, and I was exhausted. And I went back over to the picnic tables, and there was a kid who came late, and he did not get to play. And I went up to him, and I said, hi, I'm Chris. And he said, hi, I'm Carlos. I do not know how to play this game. I just came here because I thought I might meet a couple people. And I said, yeah, me too. But I'm leaving. And I know there's an open spot in the outfield that'll be just perfect for you. That's my gay kickball story.
Oh, wow. You know, and I'll tell you, I have such confidence in you. Usually I like to go over stories with tellers beforehand. But when I heard you told me the title was your gay kickball story, I was like, oh, I'm just letting her run with it. I want to be a surprise to the audience. I think it's a beautiful story, Chris.
Well, I made it for Pride because it's the 40th anniversary of Pride. And I was proud.
As far as gay kickball stories, it's the best one I've ever
heard. Oh, my goodness.
Me too. Good point,
Woo!
Joe. Good point. What do you want the audience to take away from this story?
I really want people to know what it's like not to be included. Because it's so easy, it seems like, for younger people to forget that it wasn't always like this.
Well, and once someone gets included in a crowd, mm-hmm. I find they're so thankful of being included that it's not that hard to look down on someone else and ignore someone else.
I'm not even going to go that far. I just want to get in the crowd. I'm not even going to worry about what I do once I get there. I just haven't been in it. You know, let me try. Maybe I'll be a megalomaniac and oppress everyone, or maybe I'll just be great.
Clearly, you weren't, because you allowed that young man to become part of the crowd.
Oh,
you know, that's who you are.
Oh, thank you.
This is Greg Audell with Nicole Rocherlin on the boards and Floyd the Wonder Dog asleep in my lap. And you are listening to guest storytellers Chris Gorman and Joe Crump on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for all of our friends in Huntsville. Now is the perfect time for you to dial 713-526-5738 and make a pledge that will help us toward our goal of $750. Or go online to kpft.org to donations, tell us how you're going to pay, and go to So What's Your Story as the one you designate for your support. Now, Hank, I believe, is holding down Pledge Central. And having started this weekly addiction, I'm sure he has something to say about how we're doing. How's it going out there, Hank?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic, Greg. We haven't gotten any calls yet, but you know what? It is the beginning of our pledge drive, and we typically have this dilemma because people...
No one likes to be the first one to a party.
No, they really don't, but somebody better be. I'm telling you that right now. Yeah, just a reminder that when Mary was so generous in donating $100.
She really was.
She's not matching everybody else. They have to match her. You know, she only has $9,000, $10,100 bills here. So there's only so many people she can match. Yeah. But I got to tell you, you know, just imagine tuning in and hearing, that's right, silence. That would be terrible, wouldn't it? That would really be bad. So people really need to understand that this whole thing that we call storytelling is very unique for this city. It genuinely is. You know, when this was started in 2008, and this is the truth, people said, you know, I'm not sure people will really listen to storytelling, but it's a great idea. In the meantime, we went from once a month to once a week, and now we're at 60 minutes rather than 30. Storytelling is something that genuinely connects the human condition and the human spirit better than anything else. We've had that proven over and over again. We've had stories, Greg, where there was one story where a mother talked about the murder of her daughter on air for the first time in her life. Mm-hmm. And my jaw never opened that much. And it was a story that put everybody in awe. These are the kinds of experiences that we have here. You know, we discover ourselves on air, and it's always live. And to find live shows, well, that's going to be tough. So we really would appreciate it if people would please call in 713-526-5738 JAM KPFT and let someone know that you are willing to donate to this great station, this fantastic show, and we will love you for life. Thank you.
You know, one of my favorite moments on this, of all my shows, was when I was... my guest was a wonderful woman named Sylvia Jason, who had been a child during the Chilean Revolution.
Right.
And saw her uncle, or I believe it was her father and her brother, carted away. And when she was telling the story, I looked, you know, we can see into the control room where Nicole sits and runs the boards. And her husband was watching the show from there. And tears were streaming down his face. And after the show, he said he'd been married to her for more than 20 years and he had never heard these stories. And I realized the power of storytelling, not only to the audience, but to the teller. There's something about the form that allows you to share things you just normally have kept deep inside of you. And I think that's what I'm most proud of on our show.
You're right.
Is you know, what people share.
They ring true. Stories do ring true.
They absolutely do. And you know, I've lost count of how many times I've ended up with goosebumps on my arms in the middle of a story. Well, Nicole and Tatiana, this program is committed to our community, exposing students to the beauty of storytelling, its words and images and all the wonder it brings. Tell us about a story that grabbed your heart more than any others. Let's start with you, Tatiana. if you're there, Tatiana. And if not,
what's your favorite story, Tatiana?
Thank you for translating for me, Nicole.
Well, so many stories I've heard on this show, but there was one from October. I think we had Kiki Maroon on.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Stories about when she had when she thought that she was a witch, and that she had her fear of dolls. That had been my those had to be my favorite stories so far.
I'm looking that up.
Yeah, yeah.
She always has great stories.
Well, I know, and she gets, like, as soon as she walks in, I start laughing because I know she's going to have stories that are going to make me laugh. And Nicole, what about you?
My favorite story, it's hard, and I'm not saying this to kiss butt either, Doc, but when Dr. Hank tells about the author wanting to use him in her book, and also too, it's a tie between his wife Peggy with the designated doers of everything about single moms, because it resonates so well within my life, and so I just, those are my favorites.
Yeah, so, Hank, you can tell Peggy that the designated doer of everything has worked its way into my vocabulary now.
Yeah, you know, there's just too much competition between us. Just too much.
Yeah,
she's a great storyteller.
She is a great storyteller.
That is a beautiful story.
And, you know, I'll tell you what, I think one thing else I enjoy about Peggy, we have some guests come in who don't realize they're great storytellers until they tell their story. And I love it when you see them realize that, yes, they are indeed very good storytellers, and they were able to convey the very complex things that they wanted to convey.
Yeah, you know, about an hour before she told that story at home, she was saying, and I quote, "I'm going to bomb, I'm going to bomb, I'm going to bomb, bomb, bomb."
That's the attitude.
Right. There you go.
The funniest question I get about this show is, well, how do you all find storytellers for an hour every week? Haven't you run out of storytellers? I'm like, no, because the bigger the story gets, the more storytellers, the more guests we get suggested. And, you know, we try to bring you the very, very best. But I guarantee you, in a city of 5 million people, we will not be running out of storytellers anytime soon. Well, Nicole and Tatiana, both of you redefine loyalty and commitment to our live little gem. You know, I know this seems like a multi-million-dollar production, but every single person on this team is a volunteer. And it takes a lot of time to bring you a live one-hour show, and we appreciate your efforts in each and every week. And Houston is filled with excellent storytelling venues, and I bet you will be able to fill in our audience on those right now, Nicole.
You know, that's what I do best. Fill you in, because this is one of the most rockin' poppin' storytelling towns here in Houston. But the best place to start is with our sponsor, and that's the Houston Storytellers Guild. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, that's located at 1500 Sunset. But be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs, and that's every single solitary show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio programs. And you know, we do have more to H-Town's finest storytelling lineup as well, because they should join the friends, our friends at the Moth, the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live. And the next one is coming up the second Tuesday in August, and the theme will be collaboration. Also, we want our listeners to stay addicted to So What's Your Story, and to know that, you know, not having a radio is no excuse for missing
our
program.
None whatsoever.
No, because you can listen to us live stream on kpft.org and Facebook Live.
We're everywhere.
We are right now. But don't forget to visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page anyhow, on a daily or weekly basis. Share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you like us before you leave.
Please like us.
Yes. And don't forget also, we are on YouTube and Instagram. Hey,
we're everywhere.
Follow us.
And in all seriousness, this is because of your efforts, and we appreciate it very much. We could not do it without either one of you. By the way, it only takes 90.1 seconds to call 713-526-5738. Give us a call tonight. Ease our stress just a bit, and I will thank you on the air unless you say otherwise. Again, that is 713-526-5738. We are fortunate to have my co-host, Mary Edgerton, in the house this evening. Mary and I both come to storytelling, you know, within the last few years. It wasn't something we set out to do. Mary, could you share with us what storytelling has meant to you as well as KPFT, and so what's your story?
Well, I'm going to start with storytelling. Our TV went out when I was 7, and we didn't get another one for 10 years. About the same time, the movie theater closed down, and the nearest one was 40 miles away. And my dad would get us 3 kids, and we'd be leaning against him. He'd be at the corner of the sofa with the light, and he would either read us a story. It was wonderful, making up all the voices, and these were books from his childhood. Or he would tell us a story, and we'd sit around the dinner table, and it was storytelling. When we had nothing to do, my parents would take us out, and we would lay down in the back of the truck. They said, look for falling stars. August is the month of falling stars. It took years before I found out that there's actually one night in August.
August 12th.
Yes. But we would lie there and look for falling stars and tell stories.
Wow.
And so this is KPFT has brought my family living room back to me.
Oh, I like that image.
Yes, yes. And that's one thing that KPFT means to me. And I have been listening to it actually for 40 years, KPFT itself.
Did you ever think you'd be a host?
No, and I am thrilled not only to be a host, but to be a host of a storytelling show.
I agree. And I mean, we're both in debt to Dr. Hank for sort of teaching us how to become the host that we are. Well, Mary, I agree with you that this show has been one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done. And the feedback we get from our audience is absolutely the icing on the cake. But Joe, let's get back to you. Your next story is a fusion of two important things. It's timely because of the frightening political times in which we live. And it serves as a testament to your mother. And we're looking forward to it. Would you share your second story with us?
Sure. And you're right. We are absolutely living in frightening political times. It's hard to get used to it. I hope that we don't get used to it. I remember thinking when Bush was elected in 2004. Notice I didn't say reelected. You know, I just thought we couldn't do worse. And then Sarah Palin came along, and I was like, I hope this is the bottom. I hope this is the bottom. And then, as it turns out, she wasn't. And I'm just wondering, like, who's next? Ted Nugent or David Duke or something just unthinkable. But, you know, the 2012 election was very, very important, I think, for American liberals because, you know, Bush had just finished up 2 terms. And then, you know, the 2008 was obviously just amazing for everybody, you know, the first black president, and, you know, we had high hopes, and but there was that lingering fear, like, what if he doesn't get reelected? You know, people on the left-wing talk shows were saying, like, he's going to win. The people on Fox were equally confident. We found out later they were looking at old statistics, but you know, my mother was just a diehard Democrat, and, you know, she was really more of a Hillary person. And so she was really upset when Hillary didn't win the nomination in 2008, but, she, you know, Barack Obama grew on her. And so she ended up really supporting him. And, you know, she was watching that first debate when, you know, he did poorly. And when, you know, debates are funny that way, like, because even though facts don't really matter in debates, it's sort of like who has control. And Romney was just saying all these falsehoods and things that weren't true, but it didn't matter. He looked like he was in control. So the general consensus was that he won. And my mom was really just in the doldrums. She was saying, you know, I really feel like he let us down. And because she needed that win. I think American liberals needed him to win a second term because it was like a validation of liberal values. You know, they got their second term. Why don't we get ours? Sort of thing. You know, at this point, I think many on the American left don't have the highest opinion of Bill Clinton, but many forget his performance at the Democratic National Convention when he really just tore Romney apart. He just dismantled all of his policies in that kind of folksy Bill Clinton way that only he could do it. And he really, I think a lot of people credited that with something being something of a turning point. And my mom went from just being absolutely in the doldrums to me getting home, and she was getting ready for dinner, and she was literally dancing all over the kitchen with pots and pans, and she was singing the Fleetwood Mac song, you know, "Don't Stop Thinking About Someone." And she used to love to sing all the time, so, but she was extraordinarily ebullient, and it was really great. And of course, she was ecstatic when he won, and we all were, you know, and we couldn't resist turning it to Fox and watching the chaos as they as they tried to explain it away. But you know, she was really, she had this look on her face every day after that, as though she'd just eaten a really delicious meal, like this really just contentment, like, yes, you know, because she needed that. I think a lot of Americans needed that. A couple of months later, she died in a car accident, and it was a total freak accident. She was leaving a party, and, you know, she was walking down a poorly lit road, and a car hit her. And it was just, you know, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to me, and it was pretty tragic, obviously. And, you know, for months and months and months, I just couldn't find a silver lining. But then I realized that I'm enormously thankful that she got to experience that election outcome before the tragedy, because a lot of people would be like, so what? It's just an election, you know. But for her, it was such a big deal. And, you know, I think it really, it makes it a little bit, just a little bit easier for me to handle the tragedy, knowing that, that she got to experience that.
Wow, Joe, this story really did affect me. I mean, early in the story, I was sharing your mom's angst about the 2012 election and just thinking back to how I felt at the time. And I love the image of her dancing around the kitchen, and I'm guessing that's a pretty powerful one for you now. But then I was, of course, completely shattered by your mother's passing. I mean, she sounds like she was someone who enjoyed life and made the absolute most of it. And from knowing you, I'd say she passed that on to you. What would she think, if she could even fathom, of the current political crisis that we find ourselves in today, do you think?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think she would be like most of us, where it's really hard to pick your outrage.
I like that.
It is, you know, and I think that that's part of what makes him successful as a politician, is that, you know, we seem to be all over the place in opposition. He's corrupt. He's lying. He's a bigot. He's this and that, you know, and so it makes it really hard to kind of, you know, it's like a moving target all the time.
I think that's part of his plan.
It could be, just to kind of overwhelm us. You know, I think the astounding number of falsehoods that he would tell in the campaign trail, it was just, they were not trackable. I couldn't even keep track of them, and still not trackable.
Or from the Oval Office.
Correct. Yeah. So, I think that above all, what would drive her insane is that she was just big on manners. And big on treating people a certain way. And I think that would bother her above all else. And she really would never punish me that severely when I fell short of that expectation. But she really did lead by example. And she was really able to get along with just about anybody. She could have intense political conversations with staunch conservatives. And, you know, they got along finer in the whole thing. And I think that's
I need to work on that.
Yeah,
it's that's not one of my skills.
I think I can recall you accosting a Bush supporter at a Starbucks once.
That's actually when we met.
Yeah,
that's
was.
When
it
we
was.
Met. That's
this
right.
This person had the unforgivable sin of having a Bush sticker on her car
that's
in Houston.
True. I think it was a guy. I wouldn't accost a woman.
I don't remember. But
yes, that is where we met many, many, many years ago.
Yeah. So
now, Hank, you have a gem from our archives that we'd love to share with the audience. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. David Rainey, you know, we've had 342 shows, so it was tough to find one. But David is a good friend of mine, and he is a premier actor at the Alley. And he was on, I want to say about 6 years ago, the first time. And just before he told this particular story, he had this mild panic attack while sitting next to me in the studio. Now, I went to announcements at that time, and I asked him while we were doing announcements what the problem was. And he said, you know what? I'm an actor. I usually play someone else. Now I got to play me. and I've never really told a story before, at least not in this kind of a venue. So I just smiled and I said, David, you know, you're the only one who can tell this story, man. You are authentic in every sense of the word. And he took a deep breath and he told a story, and this was it. And I just thought that our listeners would enjoy it.
Let it roll.
I often wonder why it is that certain childhood memories have stuck with me throughout my life. But there are a few that stand out, probably because of their freshness to me as experiences. And most of these lingering memories of my youth center around my little sister. There were three of us, she being the youngest and the only girl. My dad spent his life in the Air Force. After I was born, he was transferred to Cannon Air Force Base in Clovis, New Mexico. And so, he bought a house in the old section of town. It was a big house, and it sat on the corner of the block. The back door opened up into a driveway lined with two long rows of bricks to keep the car from sinking into the mud when it rained. Which came up along the street from the back of the house to a tiny porch of an efficiency apartment that came with the house. This particular day, my mom was overwhelmed with too many things to do. She was trying to wrangle three kids while cooking and fielding phone calls. For probably 15 or 20 minutes, she'd been trying to get us out of the house for some appointment she had. Part of the delay was that we couldn't find our new puppy, which we had only for maybe a couple of weeks. I don't remember if it was a male or female, but I do remember it was cute. And it was had a soft, medium brown coat and floppy ears and bounding energy and puppy breath. It was the first dog for us kids, and we were thrilled to have it. My mom finally said that we had to go, and we'd look for it when we got back. She piled us into the car, and we were off. We got to the end of the driveway, and my mom suddenly stopped the car. There, where the car had been, was the puppy lying lifeless on his side. The puppy didn't get crushed, but it was dead. We were all shocked, and I'm sure my mom was riddled with guilt. Leaving the car where it was, she had us get out, and she went inside probably to cancel whatever appointment she had. And then I remember my sister went and got her wagon. She could have been more than three or four years old at the time. The puppy would often sit in the wagon and let her pull it along the broken sidewalks around her house. So she went to the puppy and set it up in the wagon. And then she'd pull it a few feet. But when she looked back, she noticed that it was lying down. So she went back and tried to stand it up again. And then she would pull it a few feet and look back and then try to stand it up. I watched her for a long time doing this. And I guess it stuck with me all these years because it was strange to me to realize that she just didn't know and couldn't comprehend what happened. Now, years have passed since the puppy incident when we found out that my mom was expecting a baby. It was a fresh idea since we were all old enough to understand what this would mean. There was much excitement around the thought of someone new in our lives starting from scratch. My sister, of course, took to fantasizing about the new addition. Being a girl and the youngest, she was particularly captivated by the idea, especially when she found out that it was going to be a girl. Perhaps it was a newfound sense of responsibility that came from being elevated from the youngest child to the oldest girl, or excitement from the fact that she would no longer be the only girl in the family. But it set her in a whirlwind of preparation. She was always talking about what she was planning on doing and how she was going to help with this task or that and how she was going to be the big sister to her little sister. Finally, the time came for my mom to go off to the hospital. We all wanted to go, but they made us stay at home. And finally, after what seemed like days, they told us that the baby was born. But there were complications. Time passed, and every day brought with it new uncertainty about when the baby and my mother would be coming home. My sister was very anxious, but we all believed that it would be okay in the end. Our newborn baby girl hung on for 11 anxious days. My mom finally came home, and we were told that the baby didn't make it. This time, my sister did understand what happened. And the memory that lingers most vividly for me is all of us around the dinner table with nothing to say. surrounded by the whimpering sobs of my sister who couldn't stop crying. She'd been crying for what seemed like days. She had invested so much in anticipation of this new life that would transform her world. The sadness was overwhelming to her, and she couldn't quite come to terms with her feelings of grief and newfound sense of loss that was all so very final. In that moment, around the table, all those dreams and plans and hopes for what was to come were not yet ready to find their resting place. My mother finally asked my sister if she would like to go to her room. She said yes, and left the table with the sound of her sobs trailing behind her. The dining room was quiet then, except for careful forks on plates and glasses coming to rest. I don't remember how dinner ended. That didn't stick with me. But the loss of my sister felt was an unshakable memory that stays vividly in my mind.
You know, he had his eyes closed while he was telling the story. He just let the event unfold in sequence, and he felt it. And he cried, and this is what our community is paying for, Greg, and everybody, when they donate. They keep stuff like this alive, because storytelling isn't about words. It's about digging deep and finding the image that has to be shared with others. It's about taking that proverbial journey and returning people safely to the present. I appreciate the chance of listening to David.
Hank, why did you do this to me? Wow, that was a tough one. It was beautiful, but it was tough.
I bring pain to people. I do that.
Yes, you do. And I'm sitting here holding Floyd a little bit closer. I'll tell you, while I compose myself, do you have another short one for us, Hank?
I do. This one is much shorter. Lucretia Hinton, former student of mine, she was a senior 8 years ago, was going to be a brilliant opera singer. And then she found out that she had some nodules on her larynx that made it impossible for her to become whatever she wanted to do with her dreams. And she came to my office before this assignment. She was telling a story in class, and she said, you know, Dr. Rubicek, I don't think anybody wants to hear this, and I'm not so sure this is a story worth telling. And she told me a part of the story, and I said, Lucretia, trust me, tell this story. And this is what she said.
I knew what I wanted to be when I was 6. I had already had my life mapped out and planned out. You may as well have already called me an adult. I, Lucretia Cachet Hinton, was going to grace the stages of the Parisian Opera House and wow all the audiences with my amazing voice. Well, I started watching plays and movies, operas, and as I got older, I started reading on literature, comp theories, musical theory, everything. And by the time I was 13, I was going to submit myself for the New York Operetta program. I went horse when I was 17. After about a year, on the day, the very day of my 18th birthday, instead of opening that letter from the New York Opera program, telling me I graduated and I'm off to Paris or wherever else I would like to go, I was sitting in a doctor's office, being held by my mom, crying. She was saying, it's okay, Shay. Don't worry about it. It's all right. She calls me Shay when she really is being consoling me. Well, we went to see Dr. Vera Wallace. He's a locally renowned physician for his Mastery of Anything and Everything vocal. And I recall that morning that we went, the preliminary exam was him feeling on my throat. And the first thing out of his mouth was, mm. And I remember I was, excuse me, mm? What does mm mean? Mm means, mm, Miss Hinton. I didn't understand that. So it proceeded on from there. I swallowed all sorts of scopes and cameras and this stuff that they call cherry contrast. I'm pretty sure it was just cherry flavored Quicksilver. It was disgusting. And we were about there for about 3 to 4 hours, and we were waiting for the results. Then came that knock at the door. In came Dr. Wallace, and he set his clipboard down on the side counter, removed his glasses from his face, and he took them and cleaned them on his jacket. I could tell his brain was furiously working on how to tell me anything. My heart dropped. He looks up at me and he says, "I'm so sorry, Miss Hinton, but there is some permanent and irreversible vocal cord damage. And I guess I can definitely understand it. It doesn't surprise me that I was ready to go that first Tuesday that we had our assignments due. And neither does it surprise me also that I was hoarse that day. Because that day, Tuesday, February the 5th, 2013, was the 5-year anniversary of that moment for me."
And there's something else to understand. This was the clearest her voice would ever be. Literally the next day and on and on and on, it just started to plummet. And that was the last story that she told with as clear a voice as she could muster. You know, there's nothing truer than a story. And that's what we learn in storytelling. And I think that she really demonstrates that well.
You know, sort of what we were talking about a moment ago with our former guest, Sylvia Jason, I find some of the most powerful stories come from the people who say, "Well, I don't think I have a story. I don't think this is a story."
Right.
And then they start talking and the goosebumps come and you're just overwhelmed by the story, as I was with Lucretia.
Right.
Any idea what she's doing now?
I have no idea. I don't. I know that she went to graduate school in theory, music theory, I believe. But, you know, her dreams of becoming an opera singer. And she was able to tell that story and capture it all.
It was beautifully told.
Takes a lot of courage.
It was. And it was a beautifully crafted story, too. It unfolded.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let me
imagine not having these every week. That's what we want our listeners to contemplate.
And I'm so proud that we do bring this to you every week. You know, the many voices, the in-studio voices, our guests from the archives, and the people who write in and say, "I think I have a story." You know, we want to be here each and every week for you. And you can assure that we are by calling 713-526-5738 and making your most generous contribution. And we really would appreciate
it. We sure do.
And let me open it up a little bit to Chris and Joe. You know, what do y'all feel about the stories we've been listening to?
Pretty intense. I mean, achievement, loss, hope, misery, you know, the range of human emotions. But there seems to be an important lesson to be taken from each one. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Chris?
Agreed. I don't usually tell anything that's really sad. I try to make a policy of that because I'm already, you know, semi-depressed. So I don't want to share that with people. I just want to make people laugh.
Well, but sometimes your stories do have sad elements, but you still make us laugh throughout them.
Yeah, I don't want things to get too sad because there's enough. There's enough for people sometimes.
Yeah. There are, but I think you do a beautiful job of conveying things that do have sadness, but there's also humor in them and there's hope in them, you know, and I get that from your stories. I'm thinking back to the story of the car your father gave you. There's a lot of things in that story, you know, but you still leave me with a smile on my face. And guests, if you don't know the story, we will do our best to put it on our Facebook page so you can hear it. It's one of my favorite stories of Chris's. Let me ask you, Joe, who was the storyteller in your home when you were growing up?
Geez, I don't know. Probably both my parents told stories a lot. My dad's very long-winded, so probably him.
Maybe we'll have to have him on. Well, my friends, next week, Dr. Warren Holloman will be our guest. Yeah. I mean, will be our host, and his guest will be Rose Schmidt and Ricardo Nulia from Offscript, a group of storytellers from Houston's famed medical center. Thank you, Chris Gorman and Joe Crump, for your insights, talent, and encouraging words about the power of story. Both of you continue to illustrate why stories expand the boundaries of the human heart. Don't you dare move, because the Vinyl Avenger and Wild Bill are up next with the cool classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, tuning in for the night, or just chilling, join us each Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after, my friends. Peace.